And you're very welcome back to the STEM Inspirations podcast series brought to you by the BT Young Scientist and Technology Exhibition. And this week, we've got a wonderful talk between Emer Hickey, one of our BT Young Scientist winners in 2013. And she sits down with Dr. Barry Fitzgerald, the superhero scientist, to talk about failure in science and why it's important to fail and learn from your failings. So sit back and enjoy this conversation with Dr. Barry Fitzgerald.
Hello there and welcome to the BTYSTE podcast, where today we're going to be talking all about failure in science and the importance of it. I'm Emer, your interviewer, and I'm a microbiology PhD student, but actually many moons ago I won the BT Young Scientists and Technology Exhibition, which has kind of chucked me into this life of research and science. But I guess it's enough about me, so let's introduce you to our guest, Barry. Barry, please introduce yourself.
Hi, Emer. Great to be here. Yes, so I'm Barry, Barry Fitzgerald, full name. And I am a physicist by training, but I now find myself as a science communicator. I'm based in the Netherlands. I work at the Eindhoven University of Technology, and I also do lots of stuff outside of my work there as a science communicator. And one of those is superheroes, my research area, which I look at a lot. I have a YouTube channel called The Superhero Scientist. And I am someone who is very much attracted to the prospect of, which sounds unusual, failure in science.
It's a very niche area to work in for superheroes. I'm sure we'll get to that in a little bit. But this theme, failure in science, what are we actually talking about when we're talking about it?
I guess that the thing with failure in science or any aspect of life is that it's not the part that you hear people talking about too often. I mean, Emer, you're a scientist and you're working on your PhD. And when you're writing papers, you don't publish papers about failure.
And sometimes I wish they did, because when something doesn't work, you actually want to see what failed for other people. I think it's actually something we should include in scientific papers, the list of things that don't work and why.
Absolutely agree, because it's lessons learned and you can save people mistakes and wasted energy in the future if they know that, for example, you've learned that this is not the way to do it. But exactly, the way the system is set up in science, it's all about showing the great things you do and kind of sweeping the things that don't work under a rug, never to be seen again. But the thing that I think I would love to see moving forward is that starting with the early generations of new scientists that are coming up at any age, whether it's, you know, at primary school, secondary school, and moving forward, is to basically show this group that it's okay to say something didn't work, tell people about why it didn't work, and then use the lessons from that failure for improving and advancing what you're going to work on afterwards.
Very interesting. And I think, given what we're about to talk about, it might be a good idea to kind of introduce how the actual scientific process works. So can you tell me a little bit more about how it is from your view?
We're both scientists, so you'll also have an answer to this, Emer, which I'm gonna send the question right back at you then in a minute, because we're from two different fields. So I'm a physicist and I've been working in physics for 20 years. And from my perspective, this is how I see the scientific process. In physics area I worked in was on computational modeling. So I wrote lots of computer programs to simulate the world around us, everything from galaxies to polymer fluids, and even to look at technologies to process materials for renewable and sustainable energy sources. And how it all started with those areas, particularly with models, was the idea. So you start out with the idea. What do I want to do? I want to simulate a galaxy. I want to understand how piles of sand move when they collapse. And then in the computer modeling world, you sit down and you come up with what they call a algorithm. So you figure out, what is the type of model I need to put together in order to simulate this system? And normally you will, what I would have done anyway, was wrote it out in paper. So instead of straight away jumping at a computer program or a computer, start writing out what you think this model should look like, what you want to include in it, what's important, what's not important. And then the next part is the actual building, your experimental apparatus, which is effectively a computer model. And once you've built it, you've got to test it. And then if you in the testing process, which you're going to tell me as well from your perspective, is the most frustrating element of science, you've got to prove that it actually will work and it won't give you back nonsense. And once you've tested it and validated it, then you could say, right, now it's time to get some nice results out of it. Then you get the results out, and then you got to figure out what the results actually mean. And once you know what they mean, then you could start asking questions about, well, how can I improve this? What else can I learn from this? And then you decide to share all this information with the outside world. But at every one of those steps, there is numerous opportunities to fail. So what about you from your perspective then, Emer? How do you see it?
So I'm a biologist, and I think I see it from a very similar point of view. But I guess one thing that I find really interesting is that we're always working on a hypothesis. But when you're working on a hypothesis, your goal actually should be to disprove it, which seems a bit kind of counterintuitive, because sometimes it can be really disappointing when you have disproved your hypothesis. But actually, that is part of the scientific process. So like, not proving it will seem like a failure, but actually it's quite a big success. I think in biology, a lot of negative results can be seen as a failure, whereas actually it's just showing you, okay, this way doesn't work. What are the other ways that you have to use? So it's just kind of, for me, it's the way we've kind of shaped it, is that sometimes things can feel like a failure even when they're not.
Exactly. And I think that the thing in science is that many scientists and engineers have been come through a system that says, when you get something good, you got to share it with as many people as possible. Mm-hmm. And that's publishing a paper or doing a presentation or talking about it in a podcast or doing a video about it. And the opportunity to talk about when things do not work out as you planned doesn't arise as often. In fact, it probably doesn't crop up at all for people.
We pretend it doesn't happen.
Exactly.
Well, I just stumbled across this brand new drug. I woke up and dreamt of it.
Well, to be honest, some people might actually claim that. That they might have had some sort of...
The guy who invented PCR claimed it came to him in a dream or while surfing. There's some story like that.
I'm a runner, and I'm not saying I'm going to be developing anything as important as the PCR approach, but it's funny, you could be out doing something like running or relaxing, and that's the moment where you'll figure out things and you'll get this sudden, I don't want to use the word necessarily epiphany, but sudden realization that this is the best way to do something. But on the in terms of the times when stuff doesn't work, it's the system is set up to say that if it doesn't work, don't tell anybody about it. And that's wrong. And that's the wrong way to have it.
Yeah, definitely. Can you give like any examples of like specific scientific processes you've used so far in your career, just so people can get a better idea of like how it works?
So I've done a PhD in computational physics. I've worked as a postdoc, and then I've done my own research outside of what I was doing in all these different positions. So there's countless examples. The one that I really like looking back on is when I was finishing my bachelor's degree, I did a project on galaxy formation. Back then I was infatuated with the subject of astronomy, and I had a couple of telescopes. I used to spend every evening outside staring up the constellations, looking at Andromeda. And a project came up during my bachelor's in my last year to come up with a computer model to simulate how galaxies and the spiral arms in those galaxies form. So how can these actually form? And the universe is big, and galaxies, which are a small component of the universe, well, them on their own are quite big. And you've lots of matter, lots of mass. And if you've lots of mass in physics, that means you've got lots of forces. But what I did was I came up with a model that said, I don't really want to look at the forces that are between all these blocks of matter. Instead, I'm going to treat a galaxy as it's forming like a roulette wheel. And basically that the arms start to form due to some probabilities and some sort of probability of interaction between different parts of the galaxy. And cutting a long story short, in the end, I did produce a model that could produce spiral arms that look like spiral arms from real galaxies on a time frame that was similar to what you would see in the universe.
And this was in your bachelor's degree?
This was my bachelor's degree. Wow.
As a biologist, it sounds very high tech to me. Like, wow.
Well, I mean, I loved it. And I was very fortunate. The project won the best final year project of the in physics in Ireland that year in 2000, and to come back a long time. 2001 was the project and 2002 was the award. So, but that was a great project and had great results. And I got these lovely spiral arms. But in the reports that I put together, I wrote about so many of the things that went wrong. So I showed it. I said, look, I tried this, it didn't work. I tried this, it didn't work. I tried this, it didn't work. Until I eventually stumbled upon, I would say more by process of elimination, found the thing that worked. And it maybe a bachelor project is an opportunity where you can show when things don't go right. Because, you know, you're a bachelor student, you're not expected to have like everything right and have figured out every single problem and have a solution for everything.
A Nobel Prize in the bag.
Yeah, I mean, that's the dream. You know, anyone who gets Nobel Prize from work at the age of 21, wow, just, you know, phenomenal. And so that one, I think, is a little bit of an exception, but it's a process I really enjoyed. Later on in my career, during my PhD, I continued with the modeling and I wanted to look at what effectively were tiny earthquakes is what I was modeling. That's a very, very big simplification of what I was looking at. But during that process, I encountered so many technical problems with the model. And there, you know, maybe you'll echo this. There are so many times where you look at yourself in the mirror and think, is this worth it? is it worth the strife?
I say this to people very often. I'm in the final year of my PhD now. And I think actually a PhD, it's not about necessarily being smart. It's actually about being very resilient, because a lot of it really doesn't work. And you just have to, you know, dust it off and start again. And kind of that, embrace it a little bit. But
absolutely agree. There were so many things that didn't work during my PhD. I still look back at it and go, oh, I wish this maybe worked better and that didn't. But you know what? That's the way it is. I came out the other side and you're better for it. You know, you find out a lot about
a lot doing it as well.
Exactly. Yeah. You learn a lot doing it and you find a lot out about yourself as well. Mm-hmm. And you realize, you know what, I'm actually, as you mentioned, the word is resilient. I think it's a very good word you pointed out, that you've got a resilience in there that you didn't know you had, particularly when things aren't working out.
Yeah. Who knew scientists are just very resilient? That's the main description of a scientist now. Moving on, so we've talked a little bit about the scientific process and kind of your experiences, my experiences with that. And if we're going to talk about failure, I guess it's a good idea to maybe define what we mean by failure. So what do we mean by failure in science?
Yeah, I guess there's obviously the word failure in general. And you could define failure in general as just when something doesn't work out as you hoped, as you planned, or that you don't achieve a certain goal, or that you don't achieve a certain level in something. And I think that it's a misused word in the world, I think in society in general, and it's an overused word for certain situations, because even though something may not have worked out as you planned, there can still be a stealthily hidden success in there. But because our society really is built upon the idea of promoting a lot of negatives, that people tend to focus on the negatives more than they would focus on those stealthy hidden positives. And in fact, they could be bigger than the failures. But in terms of what we see, what I see anyway from failure, my definition for failure is this: I see failure as an opportunity to learn and as an opportunity that cannot and should never be ignored. And that the second part's really important. In my experience, a lot of people ignore failure. I'm going to pretend this never happened. And I'm going to just work on it.
I'm not going to tell my boss or my supervisor or my teammates.
So anyway, let's move on. How much of science is actually failure?
I think actually most of science is failure, to be honest. Which I guess you would agree with that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. From my experience, 90% is failure, but that 10% that works, that's what they see.
Yeah, that's it. And it's funny you use that analogy with those numbers, because effectively that's kind of the iceberg analogy, because, you know, with an iceberg floating in the sea or the ocean, roughly around, I think it's about 8% or 9% of the top of the iceberg will be above the water, and the rest of it will be underneath the surface of the water. And what I would actually say as well is that this kind of an analogy for me and what I do as a recreation, I do a lot of running. And of course, with the pandemic, I haven't had a chance to do any running events, but I have done marathons. And all anyone sees when you're doing a marathon is the day you run the marathon.
Yeah.
Nobody sees the training that you do beforehand. Nobody sees you running on those, you know, lovely, beautiful, you know, dark, cold, wet October evenings down a road with barely any lights, and you're getting absolutely soaked, and you're 17 kilometers into your 33 kilometer training run, and you're thinking, is this worth it? And it's the same in science. Nobody sees the scientist in a lab at 2 o'clock in the morning looking at experimental apparatus and saying to it, why are you not working the way you're supposed to work? And these are the things that we don't show, and that people don't talk about, and that maybe people don't expect scientists to talk about, because in the news, it's normally all the great stuff that people talk about.
Yeah, the sensational science, kind of. It's always that, the big headlines.
Exactly. Yeah. But what I will say is that there are occasions, small occasions, where the sensational science does take that opportunity to highlight the aspect of failure, or when some things don't work out right. And that would be, of course, the recent Artemis 1 launch that never happened.
True. Yeah.
And you know, that many people would say it was a failure, but you would look at it and say, actually, that was a success, because first of all, they realized that there was a problem and they identified the issue. And then they made the right decision about not launching when a lot of the world would have wanted them to launch anyway. And now they may have delayed the launch, but they also have delayed what I'm sure will be inevitable success with this this particular piece of technology. So they did all the right things. It's just that the media loved it for the fact it was scrapped.
Yeah. It reminds me as well, kind of this concept reminds me of a few years ago, or not, maybe it was last year, I got to go to a talk from one of the women who helped design the AstraZeneca COVID vaccine. And you know, when that was coming out, everyone was saying, oh my God, they did it in a few months, blah, 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 blah. But she actually gave a talk about how much research and how many years of research actually went into designing a vaccine like that. You know, it was, you know, 20 odd years of actual research went into this. And like that, it's not something that then you see at the output. You don't see all the time that went into it, and with that, all the failures as well.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. And I found myself over the last couple of years during science communication events, or even speaking to family and friends, telling them exactly what you just said. That while I may not have worked on the development of this, I was following the development, and I realized what people were using and basing the development of the vaccine on. And it was built on a solid foundation of knowledge over decades. And the thing is, people, even though that was there and I was telling them it was there, they were still had concerns or worries about the fact that this was all going on in the background. And it's the same with even that Artemis 1 particular vehicle they're using. Some of the technology is borrowed from the space shuttle, some of the rocket technology. And the space shuttle was very successful. Okay, there was some issues with two of them, which were not necessarily fully related to the rocket technology. But the fact that they were going back on what was there before in order to move forward with something new demonstrates, I think, in the same manner, what you were mentioning as well. And the thing is, failure, mistakes that people see or perceive to be mistakes in scientific research, can help people to move forward in the same manner. You can have success and build on those. And you can also build success on what I call a solid foundation of failure.
You know, the things not what to do.
That's exactly it. you know, it's like if you're in a maze and you're trying to get out of the maze, if you're in there long enough, you will figure out the ways that you shouldn't walk in order to try and get out. And eventually then you will get out. But your true experience, you realize that I shouldn't go this way because I know that won't get me out of the maze.
Yeah, I think kind of speaking of failure, do you think people are more afraid of failure these days? I think, you know, at the moment, there's this big, I guess maybe we're moving away from it a bit, but I think with social media, people always wanted to portray themselves as perfect. And if you go on something like LinkedIn, you never see someone saying they had a tough day at work. You see them saying, today I got a promotion. I'm so honored. Do you think people are finding it harder to share kind of when they do fail because of the pressures around us today?
There's a lot of pressure in all facets of professional life, from the academic world that I've been in, and now I'm kind of a little bit on the peripheral of the academic world. I see it. I see the pressure people are under in order to show that they're a success, show that they are doing well in their career. And I think that social media doesn't help that. I'll be honest about it. Now, there are a few exceptions of people particularly who might have got a grant, but then they share the story of how they got the grant. And with many of them, in fact, most of them, to get a yes on a grant, particularly in science, it will require a lot of no's beforehand.
Yeah, they probably had five that said no to them before they finally got one.
Exactly, yeah. But they never shared that, delighted to announce that I have been refused a grant and I was eliminated at the first stage of the grant application process. But you know what? That these things happen. I'm going to see if I can try something else new or update the grant, the application, and go for the next one. I rarely see that. But I have seen it on occasion that one or two researchers who got very high profile grants have then shared the story of how they got to that. So there is the positive, but then there's also the turmoil and the struggle to get to that big win and that big positive. But I do agree with what you've said. I think that social media doesn't help with people in terms of, if you go onto your timeline and you see just people with success after success after success, it can be intimidating. Mm-hmm. It can be an area that makes people, well, jealous of others. And it can also be an area that gets you thinking more and more about the things that you've done that haven't worked out. And you think, well, will these ever work out?
Yeah, it's a lot of pressure. But I guess it's all about embracing kind of sometimes these pressures to kind of motivate you more as well. I think that can be something that can be used.
The thing I always say to people is that, you know, and I've learned this, I've had to learn this because I've had lots of no's. I've gone for positions at universities, I haven't got them. And that's the way it goes. And you just got to go, right, that's probably wasn't supposed to be for me. And mm-hmm. I'll try the next one, or I'll try something else. And you'll always take something away from it. From my perspective, I found myself now walking on a path that I absolutely love. So I have to say, as I see myself as a storyteller, but a scientific storyteller, I absolutely love it. This is just brilliant. I get to speak to people. I get to read so much research. I still do research, but I do it for fun. So I'm not doing research to try and get a grant. I'm doing research for fun. And that's what scientific research should be.
Yeah.
It should be for fun.
We should speak a little bit more about the storytelling you do, because you actually do your research on something quite different. You study superheroes, in fact. You've written books and papers and there's videos all on the science of superheroes, right? So you could give me a little bit more information on that. But then also, do these superheroes fail? Do they have examples of failure as well?
Absolutely. So let me give you a bit of background, because there's probably people listening right now and thinking, hold on a minute. Is this actually a research field? How can anyone really study superheroes? Yeah. So I'm not saying I'm a pioneer in this, because there are others doing this, but I've focused intensely on this field over the last 4 or 5 years. If you've, just in case you've been living under a rock, superhero films have become so popular in recent years, thanks to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and also lots of other films from DC and other superhero backgrounds. And what I do is I try to figure out the real science and engineering behind what's going on in the films. In fact, I'm reverse engineering what we see there, or I try and make predictions about how a technology might work, Even if they've said it's one way, I'll say, well, maybe it's not that, maybe it's something else. And this has been a kind of my job for the last 5, 6, 7 years. So I've written 3 books. First book was called Secrets of Superhero Science. Then I wrote a book about the greatest superhero of them all, Santa Claus. And it's called Secret Science of Santa Claus. And then my last book is called How to Build an Iron Man Suit, which, well, the title tells you everything, I hope. And and then added to that, then I've written papers and journals on physiology, on physics education, in physics journals about superheroes.
Wow.
And yeah, and they've been peer reviewed. So which means in the scientific game, it means that other scientists have read them and said, we like this. This is really good. I remember one of the reviewers in one of my papers gave me 3 pieces of feedback. Number one was something about mentioning the X-Men in it. Number two was mentioning that a character was a villain. And number three, they said, I love Marvel. So that was the review from one of the reviewers.
It must have been such a relief for this reviewer to get this, such a different paper to read. Wow.
I think so too. So it's something completely different. Now, of course, in the superhero genre, there are loads of scientists and engineers, mm-hmm. and they build some great stuff. You know, you see, for example, Tony Stark building the Iron Man suit. And what you're going to see in over the coming months is you're going to have Black Panther Wakanda Forever. It's going to introduce a character called Riri Williams. Not many people have heard this character before. She was introduced in the middle of the teens, 2010s, and she built her own version of the Iron Man suit called the Iron Heart suit. And she's going to be introduced there, and she's getting her own TV series. And
oh, wow.
Yeah, it's called Iron Heart. So you're going to see that in Disney Plus as well. And besides them, there are lots of other scientists and engineers, Bruce Banner, even Peter Parker, for example, Rocket Raccoon, not a person, but also a scientist or engineer. And all of them have experienced failure in the films. And the one example I use a lot when I'm talking about failure of superhero scientists, because a lot of people think these characters in the films, they're geniuses. They never make mistakes. But the example I always use is in Iron Man, when he's building the second suit, so Mark II, in his Malibu mansion. And there's a scene where he is about to get the first proper flight and a proper sustainable flight with the thrusters for the suit. And at the very start of that scene, he says it's day 11, test 37, configuration 2.0. And what that all means to me is that it doesn't matter what he says after that, is that it has taken him 11 days of testing to get to the stage where it can actually fly. And he, which means that for 10 and a bit days, Tony Stark failed, and he failed big time. And in the film, they show him flying into walls and the thing exploding. There is the prime example of somebody who everyone looks at and thinks this guy is a genius, but yet his success of getting a suit to fly is built on 10 and a half days of
failure.
Which
is still quite rapid. 10 days to get a suit to fly, quite rapid.
It is quite rapid, yeah. Now, the time frames in a lot of these films are, let's say, adjusted for entertainment purposes. That's the best way to say it. In reality, it could have taken him 10 years and also probably a team of 1,000 people. It's not realistic for one individual to build something like that by themselves. But the process that he goes through, the innovation process, the engineering process, making mistakes and errors and misjudgments, all 100% in terms of transferring it to the real world. That what you see in the film is exactly what people go through as engineers and scientists in the real world.
And do you think we can actually learn from these fictional scientists, like in the way that they deal with these failures? Do you think there's actually takeaway messages from that?
I would think so. Now, I would point out that for the case of Tony Stark, I wouldn't look to him at the start of the Marvel Cinematic Universe and seek to learn lessons from him then, because he was a bit of a loner, didn't work really collaborate with anybody. So don't look at those films in terms of thinking, yeah, that's the thing I should do. Don't work by yourself, first of all, in science. If you're going to be working on anything, make sure you reach out, get the right people to work with you, collaborate with them.
And ask questions, lots of questions.
Because it'll always bring a new perspective. and stuff you never thought of. And we see Tony Stark doing that later on in the film. So that's lesson number one. He moves from being that loner in a room with a soldering iron and a piece of metal to somebody who is working with other scientists. And in Avengers Age of Ultron, he works with Dr. Bruce Banner. He's also working with Dr. Helen Choi. And, you know, that's an idea of how he's changed. So he's open to collaboration and he's working with them on the development of technologies. So that's, I think, one of the lessons you can learn is that if you're working by yourself on something really cool and you can't figure out how to proceed, don't try and toil with the question yourself. Bring mm-hmm. someone else in. And that's what they did. And the other thing is admitting when you're wrong. And because also if you don't admit you're wrong, you do stand a chance of failure. And the sooner you admit and you see that it's this actually isn't going to work, then you stand a better chance of reaching success. And there are instances in the films where Stark has had to kind of hold his hands up and say, yeah, my bad, this was wrong. What should I do? And he's turned to, for example, Dr. Bruce Banner to help him out with certain issues. But then in Avengers Infinity War, something that Tony Stark and Bruce Banner built didn't work out as they thought it would. And it takes Siri from Black Panther to turn around to the two of them and say, well, Stark wasn't there, but Banner was in the scene and said, yeah, why didn't you do it this way? And Bruce Banner's answer is, we didn't think of it. So if they had brought in someone like Siri mm-hmm. earlier on in the process, then perhaps they could have avoided the problem that they actually engaged with. So there are lots of things that you can learn from the scientists in the superhero films. And it's not about building superhero technologies. It's more about the process that they go through and yeah. how they collaborate with people and how they learn from mistakes.
I think really from my experience in science, it is just so important to have different opinions on anything you're going to do, because everyone looks at things in a very different way and all of our minds work in very different ways. So you might look at a problem and kind of see all different steps than what I would. So it's just so important to have so many different people from different backgrounds involved.
Absolutely. Especially,
and that's what's so important now. I mean, there's people working together from biology and physics or biology and computing, and you know, it's just becoming so much more intermingled, which is interdisciplinary, is the correct word, I believe, which is yes. so nice to see.
Yeah. And in your project, by the way, is it interdisciplinary?
My project, kind of interdisciplinary. So I kind of work in microbiology, but also in kind of like medical fields as well. So more like translating it. And I guess yours is as well. I mean, we have superheroes, we have physics, we have everything involved.
Yeah.
There's, computational there's... modeling.
That all of that there, yeah, and that's yeah. What I was doing in my research as a postdoctoral researcher in the Netherlands was looking at computer models and then hoping that these computer models could be used to help people who were building the physical equipment that could be used in the production of, for example, biofuels, that they can learn lessons okay, about cool. the best way to build it to be more sustainable, more efficient, and to also just work better. Effectively, that's yeah. what we were looking for. And I'm not saying that in the end, our research was used for that. It might take many years for that to be the case, but it's a little block in the skyscraper that is that goal. And mm-hmm. and everyone is contributing to it in that sense, in terms of the research people are doing. And what we see in this superhero genre is exactly the same thing. What you see in all of the films, using Tony Stark as the analogy, is that every single film that you see Tony Stark in, he is using his newly assimilated knowledge and all the things that he's learning from the people he's working with now as he moves through those films to build better and more effective suits. So the suit's always improving, it's always getting better. And in science and in engineering, when you collaborate with other people, you stand the chance of seeing your research advance in a way that perhaps you didn't imagine, but also get to the goal that you were striving to get to faster, I think, and in a more effective mm-hmm. manner.
Yeah, for sure. What are some like practical steps that you think people and perhaps our students who are going to be participating in the PT Young Scientists and Technology Exhibition, what are the steps they could do to actually deal with failure in science?
Yeah, it's. I think this is something a lot of people are told when they're younger. Oh yeah, anticipate that things won't work out. And what happens is people often forget that statement because you don't want to focus on the negative and you want to be focusing on the positive. And we talked about the negative and the positive elements earlier on. I think that if I was given tips to any scientist, it doesn't matter if they're about to win a Nobel Prize or in a Nobel Prize winning field, or in this case for the BT Young Scientist and Technology Exhibition, for those who are taking part in this, who have got projects, who are working on them right now, this is what I would tell you to do. I'll give you three tips, and I've got them actually written here in front of me. So I'm going to quickly say what they are. Number one is, in terms of failure, expect it to most likely happen. So just start a project and don't be perturbed by the prospect that things might not work out. Just come into it and say, right, we're going to try and do something new here. That's what scientific research is all about. We're going to try and do something inventive, something that nobody else has looked at. But in trying to explore the unknown, you will encounter unknowns. And some of those unknowns can be what seems to be something not working out, or what other people would say is a failure. And I'm not saying that you should be focusing on this happening and just, you know, tentatively taking your steps through the project. Just accept it's more than likely going to happen.
And also, you can treat it as a result, which is the thing that people kind of overlook. If it doesn't work, that is as valid as a result as something that didn't work.
Yes. So, yeah, exactly. So if you have a project and you're working on it, and at the end of the project, you didn't get the answer that you thought you were going to get, that doesn't necessarily mean that you can't share with the world what you found. So put that together and share it with everybody so they could see, look, this is what we found. Okay, so we were aiming to see this, but actually we were surprised because what we found was this. Mm-hmm. And often it's the surprising results that can lead to some brilliant, brilliant things. I mean, penicillin was discovered by accident because Alexander Fleming was a very dirty scientist. Yeah,
because he didn't use a Bunsen burner. He didn't flame his hoop.
he didn't keep a very clean laboratory. That's basically it. And that's where penicillin came from. And and for many, many, many people working in the bio area like yourself, that would be seen as a no-no when it comes to doing scientific research.
Yeah,
keep a clean area so you control, you don't have any factors or variables that could be introduced into your experiment or whatever you're working on. The second thing that I would say to people is that when you're working on your project, prepare backup plans or routes in your head in case they don't work. So you can have your plan A, and that's great, but always think about, if plan A doesn't work, what's my plan B? And what's my plan C? What's my plan D and E and F and G and however many that is? But always have those extra plans in place. And I'll bring it back to Tony Stark, the Iron Man suit, getting it to fly, day 11, test 37, configuration 2.0. That is him having backup plans. So realizing that this didn't work, I'm going to try this. Okay, that didn't work, I'm going to try this. That didn't work, I'm going to try this. He had hundreds of backup plans to get this to work.
Yeah.
And that would be the second thing I would say, is that even if you think the plan A doesn't work out and you get a result that says something, go and look at plan B and see. Maybe plan B will take us in the direction we need to go. Or maybe plan C will. And even if they all don't, it's still a result.
It's still three results.
It's
them all differently.
Yeah, three is a magic number. So you got three great results in terms of things not working out. And you can share all three of those and show to somebody, this is the things we did. This is what we found. Actually, we found that none of them worked. And this is why we think it didn't work. And the last thing, and I think this is really important, start with the first one, you expect it. And number three, accept it. So accept failure when it happens. And the reason I say accept failure when it happens is, do not let it deter you. Do not let it put you off. It didn't put Tony Stark off when he was getting the Iron Man suit to fly in the Iron Man film from 2008. Do not let this define your project. Do not let it define where you're going to go. And just look at it and say, it is what it is. Let's try the next thing and see where that could take us.
I actually had a great moment of embracing something like this through the BT Young Scientist. When I was in second year, I worked on a project and I worked really hard on it. I collected 1,000 surveys. I manually put them into a laptop with my mom. I analyzed them. I thought it was so interesting. And I didn't get any award for it at the end. I was gutted. I was so upset. And like that, I was kicking myself thinking, oh, I'm such a failure. I didn't get this. And I said, you know what? Actually, no, I'm not a failure. I just need to do something else. So on that day at that award ceremony, I said, I'm going to come back next year and I'm going to win something. And the next year I came back and we won the competition. And I swear I wouldn't have been as driven or as motivated had I actually gotten a prize that first year, because I wouldn't have kind of had that real urge of, you know, I need to improve my scientific method. I just need to do this a little bit better. So you really can embrace it and it really can push you as well, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, that would be, I would put in there as the fourth point. And it's a personal story from your perspective about what you went through. And it's a phenomenal story. It's a powerful way of showing to people that, you know, when things don't work out, and there's a time frame here, it's a year. So a lot of people could stew on that for a full year and feel sorry for themselves. And you said, no, I've got more of a drive here. I've got more impetus here to do something with this.
Yeah. And I think if you can apply that to an actual project when you're working on it, you know, if you have worked really hard and if it's not working out, kind of use that to push you to kind of find something that you think is interesting, even in that failure as well. I think that's something really important to do.
Absolutely. You could have your project could suddenly fragment into three separate projects. And then it's, you know, what you could be left with is a choice. Which one is the coolest one to continue working on? And all because the main one didn't work out.
Do you have any other kind of closing remarks for any of the listeners? I guess not just focusing on failure, but for anyone kind of trying to design a project, trying to come up with an idea, or trying to work on it and present it. I feel like you're a great storyteller. I feel like you could give people great tips on how they can actually best kind of tell the story of their project.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And perhaps we might get a chance to talk about the storytelling aspect at another juncture, but obviously we focused on failure here. The thing I'm going to say, first of all, when anyone is working on a project, discount nothing. At the start, get every single idea down. Do not discount an idea as a bad idea or as an idea that's outside the scope of what you want to achieve. Get it down on paper, have it, treasure it, and then come back to it a couple of days later, maybe 4 or 5 days later. If you're working by yourself, think about it. If you're working together with colleagues from your class, work together, sit down and look at it and go, which one of these is actually feasible? So don't discount anything at the start. I remember when I was writing the book, How to Build an Iron Man Suit, I had a whiteboard. I put all of the chapters on the board. I let the, as I saw the story going, and I left it there for a week. And then I came back and I looked at it again. And I thought, right, that's good. That's good. That's good. Now I'm going to scrap that. And I ended up had 13 chapters and I cut it to 11. And the thing is that it didn't negate what I put together. First of all, it didn't say it was bad. It just didn't fit the story as it was evolving in my head for that book. And it's the same with science. When you're doing research, you're telling a story. And as part of the story, there's always the origin story. And the origin story is where all the to and fro and happens, where you something will strike you a certain moment. And the origin story for me is the best part of the scientific process. So don't rush it. Don't dismiss it. And this is where the seeds will be sown. On the storytelling side of things, when you're telling anybody about your project, about what you're doing, make sure that you have maybe, not necessarily practice, but you have in your head exactly what you want to tell them. So my advice to everyone is this. You've got a project. You're working on it. Just say you want to tell someone what you're working on. Practice what you're going to say to that person. Take out your mobile phone or smart device. Open up the stopwatch. Put a minute on it. Start it. Record yourself then with a voice memo and a voice memo app and just talk, and then listen back to it, and then go, okay, that's okay. I'm going to redo that again, and then redo it. and try and cut then the time that you're speaking for to 45 seconds to 30 seconds and leave it at that. So, because what you want to do is you want to grab someone's attention. You want to sell. You want to sell a theory. You want to sell an idea.
And you want to pitch it.
Exactly. It's all about pitching it. And in science, and whether it's in science or business, it's about pitching it. So get that 30 second snippet of what you're doing. And whenever someone comes up to you at the BT Young Scientist exhibition and you're standing beside your experiment and someone asks you, so what are you doing? Roll out that 30 seconds and mm-hmm. make sure that it is impactful and it summarizes everything you're doing and that you grab someone's attention immediately. Because you know you want yours to stand out. And how do you stand out? You grab their attention. And with that, make it, because we live in an age where people want to have information delivered in a very short space of time. And at the Young Scientist Exhibition, there are, I don't know how many projects will be there, hundreds of projects. So how do you get yours to stand out? Make sure you can pitch it in that period of time in an effective way to suddenly grab someone's attention, to suddenly tug on them and say, oh, I'm going to stay here. I want to hear more about this. You've got my attention. Please go on.
I now feel like I want to ask you more about your project. Just
it's funny, actually. I never entered the BT Young Scientist. I never
really?
Got the chance to.
Oh, no, never. Out.
I did miss out. What's the age limit, actually? Maybe I could still enter.
I'm sure we could squeeze you in somehow. I was going to say that there's one aspect of your work that I really love, which I think people could take away from this. And it's how you've combine something that is a clear interest of yours, which is kind of this kind of superhero genre, and physics. And you've combined two things that you're really interested in, and you've made that your research topic. And I think that's really important for people to remember when they're actually trying to come up with an idea for this competition, that, you know, you can combine something you're interested in. Maybe it's gardening, you know, maybe it's superheroes, maybe it's a guitar, and you can actually apply science to that to come up with like a great research project.
Absolutely agree. I have to say, I'm very fortunate. I took what started out as my career as a scientist and working in science. And I find myself now mainly as a science communicator, and I'm still in the area of science. But I started out in science and I had all these other interests, but I always separated them from each other. And mm-hmm. and it took me many years to realize that there is the chance to overlap. And yeah. and because of my interest in popular culture, I also am interested in Star Wars and Star Trek. Don't ask me which one I prefer. I'm probably going to be very hard to decide. But I very quickly realized that they are compatible with each other and that you can overlap them. And in doing so, then you could create something and a role mm-hmm. for yourself or a direction. And that's what I've done. And, yeah. and there are lots of people who are doing this as well. So I would say this, if you're interested in, as you said, you could be interested in hairdressing. You could be interested in driving Formula One cars. You could be interested in the Rubik's Cube or chess or trying to program a washing machine, whatever that is. And if that's your thing and you can cross it over with the magnificent world of science, engineering, and technology, then you are onto a winner. Because not only do you get to do science, but you also get to work on something that you know you're passionate about already.
Yeah. I think that's probably all of the chat about failure that we can fit into this. But hopefully, you know, at the BT Young Scientist and Technology Exhibition this year, maybe there will be a project on the science of failure. Maybe someone could come up with that for us.
Well, I certainly love to see a project on the science of failure. I'm going to be
it's
there.
The stand you would be visiting.
I'm going to be there. It would be a failure on my behalf if I didn't see it. Yes, it would be. So if there is going to be a stand or a project on that, I'll be there. I'm going to be at the BT Young Scientist. I can't wait. Really looking forward to it. And I can't wait to see the projects as well. And
it's going to be so good. And back in person again. Oh, yeah, amazing.
Fantastic. It's going to be amazing. So, and I hope people have seen this. So if anyone does spot me wandering around the BT Young Scientist, call me over. And what I want you to tell me about is start out from, particularly if it's me and you happen to see me, tell me about the things that didn't work out in your project before you tell me about the things that did.
So Barry, I'm sure people here really interested in what you do. So where can they find out more about this superhero science and where can they contact you?
Yes, so I'm on a number of platforms. So first and foremost, I am on YouTube as The Superhero Scientist. So you'll find
that is a
YouTube
big
channel.
Name. Yeah. The Superhero Scientist.
Yeah, that's important inclusion of that article there. Yeah. So I am The Superhero Scientist. You'll find it on YouTube. You'll find it on Instagram, and you'll also find it on TikTok, believe it or not. There, I have currently two videos. I hope to have more over the coming months. It's a format that I'm trying to grapple with, but I'm more comfortable in the long format YouTube. You also find my website, which is bwscience.com or barrywfitzgerald.com, and there you'll find information about the things I do and more information about my books. Also on Twitter at barrywscience as well, so you can get more information about me on all of those different channels.
I've definitely learned a lot from our discussion, and I think I'll go back to my PhD now, go back to the lab tomorrow and feel very invigorated and ready to go. But thank you very much for joining us today, Barry. It was great to chat to you, and I hope that everyone watching also can take away a great message from this chat. So thank you very much.
Absolute pleasure. Pleasure speaking to you.
And what a great interview with Dr. Barry Fitzgerald, the superhero scientist, proving that not all superheroes wear capes. And we will have another brilliant interview coming up very, very shortly on the STEM Inspirations podcast series. But in the meantime, if you want to find out more about the BT Young Scientist, check out btyoungscientist.com or follow us on the socials at BTYSTE for those. Till the next time, folks. And remember, stay curious.